afternoon, a high of 88 in Walworth County, 80 right along the Lake Michigan shoreline. Partial clearing overnight, a low of 65. Then for tomorrow, partly sunny, a 50% chance of light showers and storms, a high of 82. The expanded forecast, partly sunny and dry on Wednesday. Additional showers and storms possible Thursday and Friday. Highs in the 70s Wednesday and Thursday, climbing into the 80s for Friday. The normal high for this time of year is 80. The record high for this date is 103. That mark set in 1995. The sun will set this evening at 8:30. The morning show with Gregory Berg coming up. I'm David Cole, WGTD News.
Tonight on PBS stations across the country, viewers have the opportunity to watch an absolutely fascinating and also, in some ways, deeply troubling film, a film called Web Junkie. The documentary takes place in the nation of China, and it involves a phenomenon that is not limited to China, but is especially severe there, namely internet addiction. The film tells us that China is the first country on earth to declare internet addiction as a clinical disorder. In fact, the government there has said that internet addiction is the number one public health hazard for the teenage population of China. And it is a situation which they are taking very, very seriously, in part by creating a number of centers where young people are brought who are thought to have this addiction to the internet and are brought there for the purposes of having this addiction somehow treated and perhaps even cured. And whether or not such treatment, in fact, is effective is one of the questions explored in this fascinating film, which is called Web Junkie. I am really pleased to be able to speak with the two people who are responsible for this very, very powerful film. And now I'm not finding your name. So it's Hila Meidalia and Shosh Shlam, Israeli filmmakers who are joining me via telephone all the way from Israel for this conversation. Shosh Shlam, Hila Meidalia, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you.
Thank you. We are happy to be on the show.
Really glad to be talking with you as well. Before you made this film, did you already know about internet addiction? And was that a topic you were already interested in? Or did you only become interested as you learned about this situation in China?
So I was not brought up on internet. And I was concerned about the prices that technology and internet are causing to human relationships. And I heard one day on the Australian television that one of the children in these camps was beaten to death. There are more than 400 centers like this, you know, all over China. So when I, you know, decided to bring up the dark side of the internet, I went to China. But before that, Hila and myself, we know each other for many years, and we knew that we want to share a project together. So I went to China, and I looked for this center, couldn't find it, and came back very frustrated, but still with passion. You know, to bring up this issue. Then I went again, and then I found the center. I found Professor Tao. He opened the door. I came back very happily and told Hila that the door will be open for us. And this was the moment that we decided to bring it up. So we knew about it before, We didn't know that China is the first and only one to declare it as an addiction, as a disorder. And we learned it, you know, when we, you know, made the film there.
So we are talking about a situation that, to some extent, exists all over the world. That is, it is not only Chinese young people who find themselves drawn to the internet to this extent, but it would seem that it's an especially serious problem in China for the Chinese government to take action as aggressively as they have. Have you done any study about that in terms of whether or not the problem of internet addiction is especially severe in China, or is it similar to the problems that we see in other parts of the world as well?
So it's important to really understand that actually the internet issues are it's a global phenomenon, and there are kids that having a lot of problems also in the United States and elsewhere. In China, it is more severe. One more point is that actually the games that the kids are playing, they're playing the same games in China and in the States. Like, for example, the World of Warcraft is one of those games, and those are social games. They're playing with each other. And, you know, it's more severe in China also for very obvious reasons. The Chinese government is taking extreme measures, and the internet is a big issue. In the United States, in 2013, it was added as an appendix to the DSM, but it's still not considered an addiction.
And maybe it would be important for us to say something about just how serious this situation is for a young person. I'm saying this because I have a feeling some adults are listening and thinking to themselves, I wonder if my child is addicted to the internet because they seem to be using it all the time. But what we are talking about here is a situation in which young people use it, are on the internet a staggering amount of time. Describe to our listeners just how serious this can get.
So I want to add that we decided to make this film because for us, China is a mirror to what's going on these days all over the world, in Israel. In Israel, according to a research that was done in the European Union, Israeli kids are using internet twice as much as European children, and we are talking about numbers that are more than 65% using not only games, but every other screen between 6 to 9 hours a day, and this is a lot. So I mean, I don't think that in China it's extremely severe, when you compare it to other places in the world. I think that what we see that the Chinese government took measures, to solve or to help to solve this problem, because a communist country needs productive citizens.
One of the first images we see in your film is not actually of this treatment facility, but of one of the internet cafes somewhere in China. I don't remember which particular city it is, but we see this large room and wall-to-wall computer terminals and all kinds of young people sitting side by side playing on these computers. In a country like China, are many of these young people with this addiction, are they feeding their addiction in internet cafes, or does it happen in the privacy of their own homes, or both?
A lot of these kids are going to internet cafes. First, in some places, in some areas, they don't have internet at home. And then in some of the kids that we film, there are kind of the middle class in China. They do have internet at home, but their parents are controlling it. And they are so in many times, the situation that they're at, they're almost their only way to go would be outside their home, so they're going to the internet cafe. You know, it's really important for us to also mention that, you know, those parents bringing the kids to the center because they're really desperate. It's really almost their last resource. So, you know, they tried every measure. So one of them would be to monitor at home the time of the kids.
But I want to add that the reasons in China are the one-child policy and the very competitive, strict education system. But I think that in other places, you know, in the world, the reasons will be different. But in China, these are the reasons, and it's important to say it. And by the way, in the internet cafe, you know, except as Ila said, you know, at home they are controlled by their parents. So they run away to an internet cafe, and they wear diapers not to lose a precious moment of the game. So we are talking about kids that are really, you know, they dropped off school. They are totally connected to the virtual world. And one of the things that I think that we wanted to expose in this film is the loneliness. You know, these kids, as being one child that don't have siblings, they are very lonely. So this is also one of the reasons of escaping, and of course of other you know, reasons, relationship in the family. Of course, that you know, you see it in the film.
For those of you just joining us, we're speaking with Shosh Liam and Hila Medalia, two Israeli filmmakers who have put together a superb documentary that airs tonight on the PBS series POV. The film is called Web Junkie. It explores the phenomenon of internet addiction as it plays out in the nation of China, a situation so severe that the Chinese government has set up somewhere around 400 different treatment centers around the country, and families are shipping off their children to these treatment centers in the hopes that this serious addiction to the internet can somehow be curbed. And Shosh Liam and Hila Medalia were given access to one such treatment facility, Doxin Boot Camp, a three-month military-style program located in or around Beijing for teenagers with internet addiction. All of the young people we really spend time with in the film are young boys. But when you visited Doxin, did you see any young women who were also being treated? It seemed like maybe in a couple of instances, perhaps we caught a glimpse of one or two.
There are also girls in the camp. But first of all, the phenomena is more common with men. So most of the kids in the camps are men. And actually, you know, one of the challenges that we had, you know, once Professor Tao granted us the access, was, you know, to get the permission of the parents to shoot their kids, and there were a few girls, and the parents didn't want us to film them, so this is why you only see a glimpse of them, but we didn't really focus on them. And, you know, the other thing that is very interesting is that actually, you know, the camp is located in a military base. So when we went to film there, we actually didn't ask for a government permission because there was no way we would get it. So, you know, we had to, every time Shosh and I would get into the camp, we had to, like, hide our heads and, you know, in the winter cover with, you know, big scarf, and in the summer with big hats, because, of course, Westerners are not allowed inside military base.
But I want to add that Professor Tao, after he understood that to make a documentary is not to come for a day or two, he offered us to stay on base. And that's what we did. We came at the beginning of the week and left at the end of the week. So we really stayed with the children, that gave us a lot of opportunities to see them, you know, all over the day and night. And by the way, about the girls that you ask, just to add that they are addicted, the girls that we met that we couldn't film, they're addicted to a game that comes from South Korea, How Many Husbands You Can Have. It's a very famous game. And when they got to have 50 husbands, so the parents decided to bring them to this center.
Wow. The center itself is a very bleak looking place. I mean, there is nothing fancy about it. What did this facility used to be before it was turned over to this particular purpose? Do you know?
Well, the center is on a military base, and actually it's like a military building inside the base. So, you know, I'm not sure what it was used before that, so, but it's part of the base.
So it might have been like the barracks for this military base.
No, it's still a military base, and we were allowed to shoot only in one building where the center took place. But the building looks the same as the others, and in the in outside you can see soldiers, Chinese soldiers.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So
when
otherwise,
it was raining there, you know, sometimes we would wake up in the morning and hear, you know, when they're shooting, they're training and shooting and things like that. It's on the base.
Hmm. We are told that the young people are brought here in various ways, but that in many cases they are not in any way brought there willingly. That sometimes they are tricked into being brought there, and in some cases even drugged. Tell us more about the situations or the circumstances under which most of these young people find themselves at a training camp like Dak Sing.
As Nikki says, the parents told him that he is going to ski in Russia, and they have a stop in Beijing, and he was drugged, and when he woke up, he found himself behind bars. He is not the only one. I mean, I think that no one of them came willingly to this center, but as Ila mentioned before, this is the last choice for these parents that are very helpless. And when they were told that their children are addicted and it's like a drug, as Professor Tao calls it electronic heroin, so they had, you know, to do it as parents. I think that in Israel or in America, if you took a 17-year-old child, force him and he sues you, I think that he would have won.
Mm. So describe what a typical day would be like for a young person staying at this particular facility, the Dak Sing Boot Camp for internet addiction. From the moment they wake up to the moment they go to bed, typically what is the day filled with?
I mean, they wake up really early, maybe at 5 or 5:30 in the morning. The first thing is like a kind of a boot camp training. Like, you know, they go outside. In the winter, it was, you know, minus, 20 degrees, but we are talking Celsius, so I forgot.
Centigrade,
Yeah, I forgot what is in Fahrenheit.
Centigrade, yeah.
Extremely cold, you know, like 0 degrees Fahrenheit in the winter. And in the summer, it's a suburb of Beijing, so the temperature is very similar to Beijing. And in the summer, it's extremely hot. Doesn't matter, you know, it's all weather. They go out super early and they do their training. Then, you know, they have like therapy sessions in small groups. They have more like a therapy in big groups, which is more kind of like a re-education classes. Sometimes when there are severe cases, they have like a family therapy. A lot of them, their parents are actually also on camp. The center welcomed the parents to participate, and the parents also going through like group therapy and lectures. The other thing is that they're being given drugs, mostly antidepressive drugs. So that's in a nutshell. You know, they have beyond the morning, they have some more workouts and other things. And then they have a little bit of free time where they're, you know, they're, of course, it's like cold turkey. There is no internet. They don't have any computers that they're using. And in the free time, a lot of them playing, you know, like Chinese chess or cards and things like that with other kids and start to rebuild their social skills and interpersonal communication skills. Yeah.
Most of the time, they are brainwashed.
Right. It's like a re-education, you know.
You cannot find, another word. It's brainwashing. And one of the children says it. I mean, they want us to think differently.
One of them, I think, says they are destroying our old beliefs and then making new ones for us to have. So, yeah, that does sound like brainwashing. Although, on the other hand, you described a situation in which parents find themselves so desperate with seemingly no other alternatives available, and it drives them to make this drastic choice.
Yeah, because I am a parent, and if somebody will come and tell me that my child is addicted, and the name is not so important. And Professor Tao, that is a specialist for addiction, and he says that it's the same like being an addict, to heroin or to another drug. So if this is your last choice, so you do it. And one of the damages that I think that we have to mention is that the internet, and it doesn't matter now if it's gaming or other screens that you are using all day long, your social skills are being damaged. I mean, those children are not able to socialize anymore. And I can tell you that in Israel, we have a severe phenomena of teenagers that are drinking alcohol. And one of the reasons that I heard, it's because they don't know how to speak to each other anymore. They just know to look on a screen. So when they drink, they open up. So the social skills are really, are changing, are disappearing. And I say it in a very extreme way. I know, but in a way, they are disappearing. I mean, on one hand, we think that we are so connected. On the other hand, I think that we are very lonely. And these children are very lonely. And Nikki says it in the film. This is one of the sentences that I carry with me, is when I feel lonely, I'm going to the computer and find another lonely person on the other side.
Hmm. And he goes on to say, and we really care about each other. And of course, this is somebody he's never laid eyes on. It's someone with whom he might not even ever be connected again. But he feels in that moment like this other person with whom he is connected on the internet in that moment, that they really care about one another. And in the void which he feels in his real life, so to speak, that's enough to satisfy him.
Yes, I mean, it's like, exactly. I mean, that's what he said, but also Hacker, the other child, the other boy, that his first love was with a girl that he met on the internet. Mm. So, where is the border? I mean, what is real and not real? I mean, those questions that we are now trying to ask, and I think that we are asking these questions because the technology became the architect of our intimacies. So what is real or not real? When we ask him, do you have friends in reality? And he says, no. Why? Because reality is fake. So for him, the virtual world is the truth. So, what is true? What is not true? I mean, these questions are as you said, that Nikki said, we care for each other. Hmm. And for him, it's enough.
Right.
So who am I to say that it's not enough? But yeah.
As you observed this at the doxing boot camp.
By the way, it's dashing.
Oh, dashing. Sorry.
Dashing, yeah.
Were you impressed by, for instance, the work of the women who appear to be dressed as nurses, who seem to be acting as therapists, interviewing and counseling these young people interred there? Sometimes, as I watched the film, I was under the impression that some of them are maybe kind of making it up as they go along. I mean, that this treatment facility has been erected, but they don't necessarily know exactly how to go about breaking someone of this addiction, since it's a different kind of addiction than the world has ever had to deal with before. Was that your sense as well, that they were trying to figure out how to do this even as they are trying to give treatment to these young people?
Well, first of all, it's important to say that we are filmmakers, and we came there to observe and not necessarily to judge. But, you know, there
right.
are several things that were apparent along the treatment. First of all, the therapists are very young. And you know, one of the things we learned when we were there is actually that the whole field of psychology is very young in China. And so during the communism time, of course, it's still communist, but, you know, more open. But, you know, there was not even a department of psychology in the university. So it's very clear that they're very young, the psychologists. Professor Tao is specialist in addiction. He works at the Beijing Military Hospital. He actually educated in Canada. He claimed that he has 70% success rate in treating those internet addicted kids. It's obviously a lot of the treatments are very disturbing for us, for Western eye, from the way they're being brought to the center to some of the way that they're being treated, et cetera. But again, we are not trying to judge. We just wanted to observe and to raise the issues, the phenomena, the other thing, and the other questions that we are discussing now.
I want to add that, they were not pretending, for sure. They are psychologists. This field of the addiction, or if you call it social phenomena, I think that also the Western world didn't start to find solutions because they don't know how. Meaning, if the DSM will declare that this is an addiction, so it will be treated as any other addiction. But the computer, is an integral, in our life. So it will not be taken away. So the way to treat these children is very difficult. And I think you don't have a lot of researches that were done to know what is the way. And Professor Tao is being a specialist in addictions. He treats it as he treats other addicts. What was very interesting is that China is, yes, the first one, the only one to treat it in a national, national-wide.
Right. And, of course, one thing that's very interesting is, although this is a different kind of addiction from, for instance, addiction to drugs, on the other hand, when we hear one young person after another say, I could stop playing anytime if I wanted to. I mean, the rhetoric of denial sounds exactly like what we hear from somebody who is addicted to drugs or addicted to alcohol or addicted to gambling. This belief that they couldn't possibly, in fact, be addicted. But of course, as we look from the outside in, we know better that that's often one of the primary characteristics of addiction, is that the person, the addict themselves, does not fully understand the scope of the problem or the abyss in which they have fallen.
And by the way, Nikki says it, that it's not an addiction, it's a social phenomenon. And I learned from an Israeli anthropologist that he said that a social phenomena can be also an addiction. It's not either way. But for him, you know, to declare it as a social phenomena, this is the denial that you are talking about. Hmm.
One of the most powerful moments in the film comes towards the end when one of the young people is in group therapy with his own family. And we want to leave it to our listeners to experience that for themselves. But it is a very powerful experience of, let's say, reconciliation and so on. So there are glimmers of hope in this film. On the other hand, there is much in this film that also leads us wondering if any of these young people ultimately will find their way out of this addiction. What is your impression, having spent some time there at Daxing? Is there a fairly impressive success rate, or is it hard to know?
You know, Professor Tao claims 70% success rate. We, of course, can't check and measure it. We can tell you that the three main characters in our film, protagonists that we follow, you know, we can tell you, Nikki, after he was released from the center, he went back to school, but he had some issues. He changed schools, and he's now working. Hacker, actually, is going to the university, to the art university, and Hope, actually, relocated and moved to the United States because his mother, his parents divorced, his mother moved to the States, and he went to the United States after her. And, you know, it's we can tell you that Nikki, for example, his parents are still controlling his use of internet, Hacker. He's also, you know, it's hard to tell exactly, but again, that's how claims 70% success rate.
Well, the film certainly gets us thinking about a lot of things, including the role of technology in our lives, and also the role that parents need to play in their children's lives, and the possibility that if one does not express enough love of one's child, if all you're doing is berating them and insisting that they follow strict rules, that sometimes that is enough to drive a young person into this kind of spiral downward into addiction. The film gives us much to think about and much to ponder. And again, the film is called Web Junkie. It will air tonight on PBS stations across the country, including Milwaukee Channel 10. And of course, the film then can be also viewed via the website, which you can find on pbs.org. My thanks to you, Shosh Shilam and Hila Medalia, for producing this very powerful film and joining me today on The Morning Show to talk about it. Very best wishes, and thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
And now part two of The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha Racine, Elkhorn and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. And for this portion of WGTD's Morning Show, I am pleased and honored to be speaking with Jax Peters-Lowell about her newest book, The Gluten-Free Revolution. In this book, Jax Peters-Lowell talks about her own struggles with intolerance to gluten and an intolerance that so many people have, particularly here in America. And it, of course, is a reality with which more and more people seem to be wrestling. But many other people are choosing to live without gluten in their diets and are glad that they've made that choice, even though it means bypassing a lot of things that we have long taken for granted as staples of a standard diet. All of this is explored in Jax Peters-Lowell's most recent book called The Gluten-Free Revolution. Absolutely everything you need to know about losing the wheat, reclaiming your health, and eating happily ever after, published by Henry Holt and Company. Jax Peters-Lowell, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
It's great to be with you.
Remind our listeners, although I'm sure many people know your story, since you are probably the single best-known voice in terms of living without gluten, remind our listeners of what exactly was the situation with you that led you to have to make this choice for yourself.
Well, in the 80s, when no one had heard of gluten, much less celiac disease, when there were no gluten-free bakeries on every corner, I was diagnosed with celiac disease. I should say ravaged by it. I was very, very sick. It took a long time to get a diagnosis. And there was nowhere for me to turn, absolutely nowhere. So as I regained my health, I vowed I would become an expert on this. I would read everything about it. I would never get that sick again. And as I was reading and learning the serious facts about this illness, I was also becoming really, really good at going to a cocktail party and switching plates. And I was like a sidewalk scam artist. Nobody noticed the way I was making sure I got safe food. And so when I wrote Against the Grain, it was the first book ever written on the subject. And I put all of those skills and all of that information into a book that I wished I'd had when I was diagnosed.
Hmm. One of the, when you describe what it was like to suffer with this at a time when it just wasn't well known at all, you go on to say beyond what you just said, there weren't gluten-free bakeries on every corner, but you said there were no gluten-free cartoons on The New Yorker, no jokes on late-night TV, gluten-free labels were unheard of, people stared, waiters glared. I mean, I'm really glad you say a word about that, because it helps us remember what it was like for those who suffered from this situation, that for the most part, they felt like they were suffering it in very much a unpleasant sense of isolation. And of course, now that's one of the bits of good news, is that no one who suffers from this condition or makes this decision about their diet is alone anymore in the way that they once were, in the way that you were, for instance.
No, America has gone mad with gluten. It's obsessed now. And that therein lies the reason I wrote this new book. If there was no information in 1995 when Against the Grain came, there is too much information, or I should say too much misinformation. And that's why I wrote The Gluten-Free Revolution. I'm stunned at what I hear people say. You know, I'm gluten-free. Oh, here, let me order the seitan chicken. No idea that seitan is hydrolyzed wheat. I need to lose weight. I'm going on vacation. I think I'll go gluten-free. I'll try that. So I thought all of us need to be on the same page. And I honestly bit off a lot. I mean, this is a very big book, and it takes into account all the serious issues, all the information. Anyone, regardless of whether they have celiac disease or voluntarily gluten-free, needs to know about this is how we live gluten-free. How you do it is your choice. But I did it also. I wrote it because we, those of us who are gluten intolerant or have celiac disease, we need everyone to be on the same page with us, or I should say the same plate, because we need to vet our information. It's in everyone's interest to all know what gluten-free is and how to proceed.
Can you say
then we all eat safer and we all eat better.
Hmm. Can you say a quick word about what gluten is, in the sense that of why is it that it does the damage that it does to many people very seriously, and you would contend, and many people would contend, does damage to all of us, at least to a lesser extent. What is the property of gluten that makes it, in a sense, such a dangerous substance?
Well, gluten is gliadin and glutenin. Those are two proteins. Those are the villains in the play. They exist in wheat, rye, barley, and all the derivatives thereof. Not oatmeal or buckwheat, but they have to be certified gluten-free, otherwise they're contaminated. But they're not they have no gluten. Well, in those who are sensitive or intolerant, they cause those two proteins cause trouble going through the intestinal tract. But they also cause trouble elsewhere. That intestinal tract translates to neurologic issues, issues of fertility, all kinds of issues. Now, there are varying degrees of sensitivity. It doesn't cause a problem in those who are not sensitive, but it seems that there are more and more people who are sensitive. And there are no tests for that. So it's estimated that as many as 40% of Americans are now gluten-free and sensitive to it. But we don't have a test for it. We can't measure that level, although they're working on it as we speak. So it's not, you know, it does not affect everyone, gluten, those proteins.
Right.
But it does serious damage to the body in those who are intolerant or highly sensitive to it.
One question that I think comes up from a lot of people, and they don't always phrase it this way, but this is the way I like to phrase the question. How come Laura Ingalls Wilder and her whole family could consume gluten? And anyone who lived in America in the 19th century, I mean, although certainly there were probably some people who had some kind of intolerance to gluten, but there's no way that gluten could be such a central part of almost everyone's diet to the extent that it was once upon a time. Is it that we have changed, or that gluten has changed, or that these crops have changed? What has changed that suddenly gluten is so much more serious a problem than we presume it once was?
That's a great question, and it's the larger question. I ask it a few times in different ways in the book, and it almost makes me wonder if we are the canaries in the coal mine. Is the question bigger? Should we be asking, how are we growing our grains? How are we modifying our grains? How much pesticide are we using on our food? Because, interestingly, the use of GMOs, and I think it was 96 or so, food allergies of all kinds, not just gluten intolerance, have risen. The rates of autism have risen. All kinds of issues, illnesses have risen. Our food is different. The food that our grandmothers ate was not modified, did not have excessive pesticide use, probably was more natural. I mean, in years ago, people ate vegetables and cooked meat, and, you know, they baked bread or they bought bread from the bakery. We didn't have convenience foods that are highly processed, full of high fructose corn syrup and fats and GMO empty wheat and pesticide. I mean, I think those are the questions we need to ask in our society.
Hmm.
I mean, I'm not qualified to answer them, but I certainly raise the alarm. You can't do as much research as I have done and not connect some dots and not say, we have a bigger issue here.
You do such a good job, I think, in the introduction of the book of saying that there is a lot of good news here. And one of them is that when you have even something as serious as celiac disease, the right food is your medicine.
Absolutely.
And there aren't many conditions where one can say that. It's not a table full of medicines that you're going to have to take. You do say, you know, the bad news is, of course, there is much that you have to give up, including spontaneity, and that one cannot follow a gluten-free diet casually. I mean, one really does have to be careful. I appreciate the graph or chart that's in here in which you set aside certain foods that simply must always be avoided, and then others where we have to be careful about them, that sometimes they're okay and sometimes not. Can you say a word about that sort of confusing gray area?
Yes, I will, because, well, first of all, we have a gluten-free label. And that, you know, that's not perfect. That label is not perfect. And I think that we have to learn the ingredients in foods that we're buying. It's a glossary. We have to learn them. For example, in America, starch has to be derived from corn. But imported products use wheat starch. And in Europe, wheat starch is considered okay. Because it's 20 parts per million. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, I could get into the weeds all day with it. But you have to learn it, and I would say quickly that to use the label only and not learn the ingredients, which are all in the book, they're all listed, is like, you know, using spell check before you learn how to spell. You really you trust yourself.
Mm.
You know, you have to trust yourself. And spontaneity... is something that we can work on. We do lose some spontaneity. But I have to say that years ago, when somebody offered me a gluten-free pizza, which was so rare, or a brownie, I ate it. I could be stuffed, and I would eat it, because I never knew when I would get it again. But now we can say, you know, I don't think I'll have that pizza, because there are three places in my city alone where I can go and have a really, really good gluten-free personal pizza.
And so, you know that it will be absolutely gluten-free.
Absolutely, yeah. Gluten-free, yes. But I think that there are certain skills we have to still maintain, and that is in a restaurant where you maybe don't know the chef or can't really discuss it, when you order a salad, let's say, that has croutons and you really want it, you say to them, could you please toss my salad in a clean bowl? Because otherwise your crouton-free salad is being tossed in a bowl that's already been tossed with croutons. Or could you scrape the grill to put my burger on? Little things. Or in an ice cream parlor, could you please wash the scoop? Because maybe your flavor, you know that your flavor is gluten-free because you've done your homework, I hope, online with the company you like. But maybe that scoop just scooped cookie dough.
Right. You have a list of basic rules of advice, and several are really interesting. I'll let you just grab whichever one especially intrigues you. But I appreciated basic rules like look for gluten in unexpected places.
Right.
Or it's better to look silly than to get sick. And if you don't understand it, don't eat it until you do. I mean, these are really great lessons, really for all of us to some extent, and particularly for those who need to or choose to live gluten-free.
Yes. I mean, you know what happens in a restaurant. I mean, one of the funniest things is a roux, R-O-U-X, is the basis for, I don't know, a trillion sauces, and it's always flour and butter. Mostly French sauces. So if you don't, you know, it's embarrassing not to know what that is. And, you know, it's not a cheek color. Right? It's not rouge. So you have to, you know, you feel everyone staring at you. Could you tell me how this soup was made? Or I have this pasta. Would you mind cooking it for me? But, oh, by the way, could you please put it in a separate pot? Because otherwise you're in with the other flour water. So a lot of people make mistakes because they don't know and they're embarrassed about it, or they know a lot and they're really hostile and negative. It's not an adversarial thing. Chefs love to nurture people. Who would stand on their feet for 48 hours, right? So when you say to a chef, I would love to have that dish, but you know, I have to be gluten-free. I have to have a safe meal. Would it be just as good without this or that? Or is there something you can put? And if you do that, you have honored the chef. You don't want to ruin the chef's dish. And you've honored them, and they will just, as I like to say, eat out of your hand.
Your book also includes a wonderful section on gluten-free thinking, in which you pose a number of questions, and of course there are all kinds of wonderful recipes as well. It's a tremendous resource for anyone who needs to live their life without gluten. Again, the book is The Gluten-Free Revolution, published by Henry Holt. Jax Peters-Lowell, thank you so much for this great service you've done to so many people,
and thank you for writing this book.
It's
good to be here, and I would say go to jaxlowell.com, and there's much more information for your listeners.
Very good. Thank you again for joining me.
Thank you.
The National Weather Service has just updated its hazardous weather outlook for the area. It essentially reaffirms earlier forecasts. More severe storms are possible this afternoon and evening. They say the entire area is in a slight risk zone for severe storms. That means hail, strong winds, and potentially even a tornado are all possible. Stay tuned for classical music from Wisconsin Public Radio coming up momentarily. At noon, we'll have the WGTD Midday News, and we'll update you on the power outage situation in our listening area. This is WGTD HD.